Welcome, Liz. Yaro, welcome, Jean. Welcome, Edie. I've noticed a few adaptations to my body over the last couple of days. It's nice to be in the body so completely. Such an opportunity these 5 days to really listen to my body. I usually get a little more sleep, but you know, the body gets used to this. Not forever, but it's part of keeping me in the body. Is this? Oh, there's sleep. There's awake. You know, I've had to adjust my caffeine level, which is kind of unconscious usually, until we're doing something different. And then it just takes a couple of days for that to work itself out. I'm moving a little slower. My body's a little tired. My joints have a little ache, but actually after these couple of days, everything is bending in the right way. I've kind of limbered up. So you know, our bodies adapt to this practice over the course of the 2 or 3 or 5 days that we're all here together. Once again, it's that balance of being nourished and putting in some effort in this practice. We chanted this morning in Dogen's recommendation to all people to practice Zazen. He said, Zazen is not learning meditation. It's the Dharma bliss. It's the Dharma gate of bliss and repose. It's like a dragon taking to the water, a tiger taking to the mountains. So, bliss and repose, you know, that's not so different. Excuse me. It's not so different from Buddha's Mindfulness Sutra. Breathing in, I calm the bodily formations. Breathing out, I calm the bodily formations. So we put a little effort into our posture. And part of that effort is, how am I comfortable on this cushion? What supports do I need? What bench do I need? What chair do I need? Because the Buddha has instructed us to calm our bodily formations, to really settle down, to get comfortable. And I imagine Dogen's bliss and repose is what comes up to meet us, is what comes up to nourish us. It's the chicken and the egg, the pecking from both sides. I vow for these 5 days to sit up straight, to sit still, to calm my bodily formations with a cushion as I need it, with a little stretching and yoga as I need it, and I have confidence. This is our faith. This is how Buddhists describe faith. It's because we've done this practice time and time again that we know that we're going to be met from the other side with that bliss and repose. We'll be nourished if we put this effort into calming our bodily formations. We've been looking at the Ocean Mudra Samadhi, fascicle by Dogen, and the translation by Kaz Ta-Nehisi and Reverend Catherine Thanis. I think on Wednesday night, most of you were here, even if you haven't been here in Sesshin, I read kind of the opening. I'll just briefly kind of recap. Buddhas and ancestors continuously maintain ocean mudra samadhi. While swimming in this samadhi, they expound, realize, and practice. This is called coursing along the bottom of the deepest ocean. The Buddha said, "Elements come together and form this body. At the time of appearing, elements appear. At the time of disappearing, elements disappear. When elements appear, I do not say I appear. When elements disappear, I do not say I appear." So we've looked at the process of appearing as that body that we maintain that's on the ground of the deepest ocean, as the body that's formed by all the elements that come to us in that primordial ooze of our lives. And we're not judging which elements are good, which elements are bad. This is a body that accepts all that come together. He says, they're not always in alignment. They don't always come together sequentially. So it's not like we're making this plan of what's going to be in our life. We just accept all that comes into our life. And, you know, we've done it. We haven't been picking and choosing our life, really. It's just, you know, here we all are, 30-ish, the rest of us, 60-ish. We think there's lines on the swimming pool that we're swimming in, and that we're just, we're planning it out. But that's not been the case. We've accepted it, and here we are, many decades later. Elements have been coming and going. Some are quick to come and quick to go. Some of the elements have lingered. But, we took them all. And this is what we know. This is what we're fully filled with, standing on the bottom of the ocean. These are the tools that we use more at the top of the ocean, where we're dealing with home and friends and family and work. I think when we continuously maintain the ocean muddha, mudra, samadhi, that's when we're really kind of aware of our ground, even as we're dealing with the storms, the doldrums, the tsunamis at the surface. And like I said, Wednesday, we're doing a little more practice in this sesshin, getting to know that bottom of the deepest ocean in our lives, so that we can more freely access it. It's there. It's right here in our lives and in our bodies. But I think I get a little more practice up there at the surface. So I've appreciated this time to get to know the terrain down there. Oh, I remember that element. I remember that. I know that. And I think that's, I talked about my cousins. I think that's what they remind me of. They make me remember all of those, those are the, a lot of the elements in there. And then we talked about, as the sutra says, at the time of disappearing, elements disappear. When elements disappear, I do not say I disappear. We looked at Dogen actually talks about several ways of disappearing. But he associates disappearing with the countless hands and eyes of Avalokiteshvara. And he associates disappearing with disappearing is the activity of Buddha ancestors. Disappearing has been magnificently expressed as countless hands and eyes of Avalokiteshvara. It is unsurpassable nirvana. It is called death. It is called freedom from attachment. It is called the abiding place. Those are some of the aspects of disappearing. I talked about some of the people we know that have died: Catherine, Jean Marie, Craig. I think we all had the great benefit of meeting the Bodhisattva of compassion when they died, and gave us such an important teaching, pointing to our Buddha nature. That's how I connected with disappearing, as magnificently expressed the countless hands and eyes. The other aspect of disappearing that he mentions is just the momentary, in every moment there is appearing after that brief moment, no matter its length, there's disappearing. And our practice is freedom from attachment as we practice with the elements disappearing. We're not holding on. This is liberation from suffering. This disappearing is the third noble truth of cessation, of the cessation of grasping and cessation of suffering. So this is the activity of our Buddha ancestors, disappearing, and it comes with it comes with an association, a blessing from Avalokiteshvara. What a nice thing. What a nice thing. Appearing and disappearing. I do not say I appear. I do not say I disappear. And this is our body coursing along the deepest ocean of our lives, that is informing our actions up on the surface. And we've been visiting those deepest oceans in this sesshin. We have this opportunity. Buddhas and ancestors continuously maintain ocean mudra samadhi. While swimming in the samadhi, they expound, realize, and practice. Dogen goes on to say, samadhi is actualization. It is expression. It is the time of night when a hand is reaching back, groping for a pillow. When the hand reaches back for a pillow at night, this groping is not limited to thousands and millions of eons, but it is, as the Buddha says in the Lotus Sutra, I am always in the ocean, expounding the wondrous Lotus Sutra. So, when we remember the deepest ocean of our lives, as we continuously maintain this ocean mudra samadhi, this is the actualization of our life. This is the actualization of our practice realization. And what is it expressing? We're expressing from our deepest ocean. Always we're in the deepest ocean. And that's the part that's hard to remember. That's the part where we get distracted on the surface. We forget that we're in the deepest ocean. But we're always in the ocean, expounding the wondrous Lotus Sutra. And you know, the Lotus Sutra, briefly, Buddha says to all of his disciples, and I read a little bit of it before, there was more than a few disciples there. There was tens of millions of myriad and billions of disciples in all their Buddha lands. He said, you know, some of you, I've been teaching a couple of things, depending on your natures. I've been teaching a couple of paths to liberation. Some of you are my arhats, or practicing arhats, and your practice of liberation is letting go, watching your grasping, watching your desire, and your practice is extinguishing this desire to reach nirvana, that total extinction, the disappearing of all elements, not holding on, and reaching that shore of nirvana, of total extinction. Some of you I've been encouraging to save all beings, to teach that third noble truth of letting go of desire to all living beings, and helping all living beings be liberated from suffering. And I know that you're practicing that as well, and then you can step over to that shore of nirvana, to complete perfect enlightenment. So I've been teaching those two paths. But now that you're all here, I want you to know that there's just one path. And you know, they were called vehicles. So some of you have been traveling on the arhat path. Some of you have been traveling on the bodhisattva path, the Mahayana, with Mahayana teachings, in that other vehicle. But the one vehicle is just Buddha vehicle, the one vehicle where all of you are on the path. Both paths lead to Buddhahood and liberation for all beings. So he kind of unified his two schools of arhats and bodhisattvas. You know, some of you are my oldest students. Some of you are my newest students. You're all together now on one path. And you'll all receive Buddhahood on this path. So the beginning of the Lotus Sutra is just several chapters of calling out to different of his students or groups of students, and promising them their Buddha lands, their Buddha fields. And the expression of the Ocean Mudra Samadhi. What am I expressing when I'm standing firmly on the ocean floor of my life? Comes from his story of, or not his story, his meeting at this big retreat. One of them there was Devadatta. Devadatta was his cousin. Devadatta was Ananda's brother and a longtime student of the Buddha, part of Buddha's large group of followers. But, you know, Devadatta had a little bit of ambition. Devadatta said at some point, you know, why don't you turn this organization over to me? I've been a pretty good student. And you're not getting any younger. I'd be glad to take this off your hands. Thank you for introducing me to all of those underground. I'll be glad to keep teaching them, all the bodhisattvas. Glad to have met them all. Why don't you turn this organization over to me? And I think probably in a kind way, but according to the story that I read, Buddha said, you know, I'm not even ready to turn it over to Shariputra or Manjushri or Maitreya. You know, I may be pointing out that there were other people to consider in this topic of succession. I'm sure he said it nicely. And he just said it's not time for succession yet. But Devadatta, you know, his cousin, brother of Ananda, didn't take that so well. And he tried to have his own followers, and actually said that 500 of his Sangha mates went off with Devadatta to do their own practice, which, you know, which I read was pretty much Buddha's teaching. You know, Devadatta was Buddha's student, so they were just going to practice Buddha's teaching by themselves. And even 500 followers wasn't enough. And so Devadatta plotted to kill the Buddha, and he sent those 500 followers to kill the Buddha. Buddha actually, you know, when facing these 500 followers, compassionately invited them back into the original Sangha, and they once again joined up with Buddha's Sangha. And this infuriated Devadatta, so he was going to have to take the matters into his own hands. So when the Buddha was on his alms round, the Devadatta rolled a boulder over a cliff to try to kill the Buddha. And he missed. And he said, I've got to try something else. So I guess a really good plan in those days was to intoxicate an elephant and shoo him into the midst. And it didn't sound to me like a good plan, but I guess that was done. But this piece that I read said Buddha had his own elephant handling skills and tamed the elephant. And at that point, Devadatta gave up. Devadatta went off and continued to practice. You know, he had some followers, apparently. And apparently, after Buddha died, there were Devadatta followers that practiced a little differently, but generally, they apparently had a very, according to what I read, had a very, very effortful practice. You know, they only practiced outside, long periods of meditation. It was a very disciplined practice. So apparently, and there was a school of Buddhism that got its start with Devadatta. But this that I read also said that Devadatta visited the hell realm, at least for a while. So that's Devadatta's story. Everybody supposedly knows this story. And I didn't know it so well, because they don't go into it, and the Lotus Sutra doesn't say it. The Lotus Sutra just has Buddha pulling Devadatta up onto the dais. I think they were floating on lotus pads, and offered him his own Buddha land. So everyone could see that you know, when you're on this path, you know, this is the path to Buddhahood. This is our one vehicle. He tells the story that in their past lives, Shakyamuni Buddha was a king who was very involved in practice. For the sake of Dharma, he gave up his kingdom and throne. He left the government to the crown prince. He sounded drums and sent proclamations in all directions, seeking the Dharma. I want a teacher. For the rest of my life, I will be the great provider and servant for anyone who can teach me the great vehicle. And on this journey out of the kingdom, a seer came to the king and said, who was Shakyamuni Buddha in a past life. This seer says, I have the great vehicle sutra named the Lotus Flower of Wonderful Dharma. The Lotus Sutra was already around according to the Lotus Sutra long before Shakyamuni. The seer said to the future Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, if you obey me, I will explain it to you. Hearing what the seer said, the king became ecstatic with joy and immediately went with him, providing for his every need, gathering fruit, drawing water, collecting firewood, laying out his food, yet never feeling tired physically or emotionally. During this period of service, he did this all for the sake of the Dharma. 1,000 years passed in this service, in which he diligently provided for the seer so that he would lack nothing. So Buddha told this to the crowd with Devadatta by his side, and then said, of course that king in those days was me, and that seer was none other than Devadatta himself. And so he is a long time practitioner, a long time student of mine. It doesn't exactly say in here, let bygones be bygones, but one assumes that that was implied, and says that he will have his own Buddha land. And right after he gave the Buddha land to Devadatta, he invites Manjushri up. Then Manjushri, sitting on 1,000-petaled lotus flower as large as a carriage wheel, accompanied by bodhisattvas who had come with him, also sitting on treasured lotus flowers, emerged naturally from the palace of Sagara Dragon King in the great ocean. Suspended in the air, he went to the holy eagle peak, got down from his lotus flower, went before the Buddha, and reverently prostrated himself at the feet of the Buddha. The Buddha asked Manjushri, when you were at the dragon palace, how many beings did you convert? Manjushri responded, "The number of them is innumerable, incalculable. It cannot be expressed in words or fathomed by the mind. Just wait a moment and there will be proof." And before he had finished speaking, innumerable bodhisattvas sitting on treasured lotus flowers emerged from the ocean and flew up to Holy Eagle Peak, where they were suspended in the air. All these bodhisattvas had been transformed and delivered by Manjushri. They had done bodhisattva practice and together discussed the six transcendental practices, the six paramitas. Those in the air, originally shravakas, following the arhat path, taught arhat practice, even though they were now all practicing the great vehicle principle of emptiness. Then Manjushri said to the Buddha, "This is the result of my teaching and converting in the ocean." Manjushri went on, "What I always proclaimed when I was in the ocean was only the wonderful Dharma Flower Sutra. What I always proclaimed when I was in the ocean was the wonderful Dharma Flower Sutra." So, Dogen turns it around a little bit. When the hand reaches back for a pillow at night, this groping is not limited to thousands and millions of eons, but is nothing other than, "I am always in the ocean," expounding the wonderful Lotus Sutra. So this is Dogen's encouragement for us always to remember our feet firmly planted at the bottom of the ocean of our life. And this is where we this is where all of our actions come from, even though our actions are all kind of at the top. This is where you know we can be supportive of friends and family who are struggling in their own storms, their own doldrums, their own tsunamis. Sometimes we want to just hold on to them and say, calm down. I'm here with you. But sometimes that kind of support, you know, we're kind of lost in that kind of, we kind of get pulled in by that, by the weather. So this is why we have to always be in the ocean with Manjushri, expounding the Lotus Sutra. This is where, you know, we want to give Buddhahood to our friends that are suffering. And we can't do that flailing around on the top with them. We have to support them with our feet firmly on the depth of the ocean of our life. I remember swimming lessons in the time that I spent with my cousins in San Luis Obispo. It was the Nuss Pool, and every summer It seemed there was a week before in the middle, or in some part of the summer, another week, we took some swimming lessons, you know. Some of the time we learned the crawl, and then we, you know, learned other strokes. There was one week where, you know, after we'd learned all the strokes, the teacher just had us do laps, lots of laps. I hated that week. You know, is it okay? Let's start off with 20 laps of the crawl stroke. And, oh, 20 laps. And you know, then you grasp onto the side and take a few breaths. Oh, now let's do 20 laps of the breaststroke. It didn't occur to me then that, you know, being a good swimmer was also being a strong swimmer. You know, I just wanted to learn the strokes. I wanted to learn the strokes just perfectly. But one class was life-saving. And, you know, we learned to fill up our blue jeans with water. With air. Did you ever do that? And so they're kind of like a flotation device. And another technique we learned was saving somebody else. Follow me here. It's a long story, like Devadatta. Their suffering, you can guess this, can't you, Liz? Their suffering along the surface of the water, they're splashing about. They can't do it. They can't stay up. And if you went and grabbed them, you'd just be pulled down. You'd be a dead duck. So what we learned was to swim deep and grab their legs in the stiller part of the water. And you turn them around, and then you kind of climb up them from the back so that they can't grab you. And then once you're up at the top, you can grab them around the back because they're really tired, and they feel your support at that point. They say, "Oh, you know, he was here, he was gone. But there he is again, and I can feel him. I can feel his body keeping me up." And then he, you know, relaxes. Of course, this was the other 8-year-old that was we were doing it with. So I've never done this on a grown-up human. Only with another 8-year-old. But that's kind of this story of the Ocean Mudra Samadhi. Really knowing the terrain, knowing your terrain. Really able to access, you know, that deepest part, that part that has all the possibilities available to you, a part of you that rejects nothing. In our practice of saving all beings, just like Shakyamuni's practice, we need different skills for each one of our friends and family. And we can't identify all the elements in our life as, you know, oh, this never worked. That's a good one. That's a bad one. We've taken it all in. We know that. We know the elements of this body. And when we meet a struggling friend, we need to have access to all of those elements in our lives, those deep elements. And And the Lotus Sutra teaches this. And Dogen reminds us of this teaching. I am always in the ocean preaching the Lotus Sutra. May the serious, devoted, disciplined practice of Devadatta be dedicated to saving all beings, to the relief of suffering, and uncompared, unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gives.